Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In 2012, a new charity bursts onto the scene. It's called Believe in Magic and it grants wishes to seriously ill children. It has the support of the biggest boy band in the world. One Direction. It's run by an inspirational 16-year-old girl called Megan Bari, who herself is battling a brain tumour.
I've been in and out of hospital and seen so many other very poorly children.
But when questions arise about her story, they reveal she could be facing another very different danger.
What is this girl going through?
It wasn't supposed to end like this.
Listen to Believe in Magic with me, Jamie Bartlett.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 3rd of May, these are our main stories. The Kremlin has accused Ukraine of trying to assassinate President Putin. 8 school children and a security guard have been shot dead by a fellow pupil in a rare mass shooting in Serbia. The UN humanitarian chief and secretary general are leading efforts to get aid into Sudan in visits to the country and nearby Kenya. Also in this podcast, a few days before the coronation of King Charles III in Australia, Republican sentiment is stirring again.
We're an ancient country, but we've grown up a lot. I think it could be time for us to have an Australian as head of state.
Not one of us.
Not voted for by us.
Not accountable to us in any way.
Shouldn't our head of state be an Aussie?
Russia has accused Ukraine of launching 2 drone attacks on the Kremlin overnight. Officials said it was an attempt on President Putin's life and described it as a terrorist act. They said the drones had been disabled by Russian defences. There's been no independent confirmation of the incident. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, gave the latest to my colleague Tim Franks.
I should stress, Tim, that all we have to go on right now is a statement that was issued a short while ago by the Kremlin press service and a couple of videos which have appeared online. According to the Kremlin statement, there was an attempted Ukrainian drone attack on the residence of the president in the Kremlin overnight. The statement from the Kremlin says that there were 2 drones, but that the Russian military and Russian special services used radar systems to put the drones out of action. And so there were no victims, no damage, as a result of the drones crashing. On a couple of the videos which have appeared, you can see some kind of explosion. Now, the statement ends by saying that the Kremlin views these actions as a planned terrorist attack and an assassination attempt on the life of President Putin, and that Russia reserves the right to respond whenever and wherever it considers necessary. Now, I have to say, this is all very surprising for a number of reasons. I mean, you know, the Kremlin is heavily guarded. Nothing like this has happened before, not that I can remember. And also surprising because earlier today when President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, held his daily conference call with journalists, he made no mention of this. It was only after the conference call that they put out this statement. So it is rather strange. And it comes just a few days before the big military parade, the Victory Day parade on Red Square to mark the Soviet defeat of Nazi Germany.
Right. And I want to ask you a bit more about victory parades. I know that they've said that they're not going to cancel the one in Moscow. But have they given any details as to, you know, where these alleged drones came from? Are they saying that they were sort of piloted all the way over from the border, or are they saying that they were sort of launched by agent provocateur in Moscow? I mean, have they given any details on the,
no,
on the attack?
No more details. They're just talking about unmanned aerial vehicles, in other words, drones. So where they came from, who launched them, we simply don't know. From what I hear, Ukraine has denied any link to this this alleged attack. But we have very few details at the moment to go on.
Okay. And just in terms of those Victory Day parades, Moscow's is going ahead, but have there been any effects of these Ukrainian drone attacks that have occurred over the border, allegedly, have they had any impact on Victory Day parades elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, over the last few weeks, I suppose, a number of Russian regions, particularly those bordering Ukraine, but not only, have decided not to hold their annual Victory Day parades, citing security concerns. Now, the Kremlin has been saying all along that the biggest parade of all, the Moscow one across Red Square, will go on as planned, and they've repeated that today after the announcement about this alleged attack. But there are still a few days to go before that. And certainly this adds to the sense of nervousness here at the moment.
Steve Rosenberg. Last September, underwater explosions damaged the Nord Stream gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea, cutting Russian gas supplies to Germany. But who did it? Fingers have been pointed at Western countries, Russia, and unidentified pro-Ukrainian elements. Official inquiries into what caused the blasts are continuing, but now four Nordic broadcasters have done their own investigation and say it shows Russian Navy ships were nearby shortly before the blasts. Our security correspondent Gordon Carrera told me what he made of this development.
Not conclusive evidence, but certainly an interesting indicator and building up a pattern, including some evidence we've seen elsewhere in recent weeks, suggesting that there were Russian Navy ships in the area. The Nordic broadcasters tracked a couple of ships in June, which appeared to go over the pipeline where the blast would later take place in September, and then another vessel going again in September a few days before the blast, and acting, they say, unusually in the way it would loiter, and also some of these vessels having the capability to do seabed surveillance and also potentially to carry mini-submarines. But you're right, it is not conclusive, and there remain lots of different theories, lots of competing claims, people saying the US did it, people saying pro-Ukrainian groups but not the Ukrainian government did it. But it is also notable that last week the Danish Defence Command said it had also taken a number of photographs of another Russian vessel around that site where the blast took place in September, shortly before the blast. So I think these are very interesting indicators building up a possible lead, but certainly we're not there yet and we're still waiting for that investigation to conclude.
Just suppose Russia was behind it, which is the implication. But why? Because Russia could have switched the pipeline off anyway.
Well, that's right. And I think that confusion has always been one of the big questions surrounding this, is motive. Why would Russia blow up effectively its own pipeline? Now, there could be reasons from everything from insurance to a signal to the West that they can't turn it back on that might lead them to do it. But you're right, the complexity of motive is one of the questions which has left this such a mystery.
Our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera. In Serbia, 3 days of national mourning have been announced after a school shooting in the capital, Belgrade. A 14-year-old boy has been arrested after children and staff were shot in a school early on Wednesday. 8 children and a security guard were killed. Another 6 children and a teacher were wounded. Some of them are said to be in a critical state. This mother says her daughter, who survived the attack, was in the same class as the suspect and told her what happened.
My daughter saw the security guard collapse right in front of her. She'd heard shots before that but thought they were firecrackers. But when she saw the security guard fall, she immediately rushed back to her class. She was scared. She told a teacher there'd been a shooting upstairs.
The police said the boy, who was apparently using his father's gun, had planned this attack in detail. At a news conference, a visibly shocked education minister, Branko Ružić, gave his reaction.
It is unthinkable. How, when you see the scenes at the scene of the place, what the children have been through, and the teachers who have tried to protect the children.
Our correspondent in Belgrade, Aleksandar Miladinovic, told me the latest.
8 pupils in a prestigious elementary school in downtown Belgrade were killed in a shooting spree when their fellow friend from the same school at the age of 14 showed up with a gun, probably owned by his parents, and started shooting first at kids and then also at the history teacher and the security guard that worked at the school. 6 more pupils are still treated for injuries in Belgrade hospitals. Also, the history teacher's health condition is very difficult, and the doctors are still fighting to save her life. The parents of kids that went to school gathered around the school in downtown Belgrade, and it took, for some of them, hours to get in touch with their kids. The Minister of Education has reported that the whole system was in place. The school was under video surveillance. There was a security guard and a police officer within the schoolyard. Minister of Education announced that the Serbia would declare 3 days of mourning, also naming this tragedy as the greatest in Serbian history.
As you say, the schoolboy who is thought to have done this is said to have been using his parents' weapon or a gun that belonged to his parents. There are a lot of illegal weapons in the Western Balkans, aren't there? In part because of what's left over after the war of the 90s.
It is one of the sad consequences of the wars of 90s. A lot of weapons still circulating in the Western Balkans. Also, a lot of weapon-owning culture still alive in the Western Balkans from the times when the law was not enforced in the 90s in former Yugoslavia. However, we still don't have the details whether the parents of this boy had registered this gun or they owned it illegally. We are still waiting for confirmation from the authorities of the specific piece of weaponry.
And I know we cover school shootings in other parts of the world quite regularly, but in Serbia, in this part of the world, this kind of thing is very rare, isn't it?
Absolutely. This is, without any doubt, the biggest tragedy of this kind in this part of the world. And that's one of the reasons why Minister of Education of Serbia, Branko Ružić, called it the biggest and the saddest catastrophe and disaster in the Serbian history. It's been a troubling times in the Balkans in the past few decades, but events like this are far from reality safe. Schools in Serbia were a safe place for kids. However, after this morning, many, many things would obviously change.
Aleksandar Miladinović in Belgrade. Police in Europe have targeted one of the world's biggest criminal networks in a series of raids across the continent. The 'Ndrangheta is one of Italy's most powerful and feared mafia groups, controlling the bulk of the cocaine flowing into Europe. It's also involved in money laundering and fraud. Most of the arrests were in Italy, in the southern village of San Luca, where the 'Ndrangheta has a base. But the evidence which led to the arrests was gathered in Belgium. Eric van Dijs is a spokesperson for Belgium's federal prosecutor.
Il s'agit sans doute de la plus grande opération jamais menée contre la mafia calabraise en Europe.
It's likely the biggest operation ever carried out in Europe against the Calabrian mafia. More than 1,000 police officers were involved in this morning's raids in Germany and 1,400 in Italy. All of this was based on a Belgian dossier. At the same time, raids have been taking place in Spain, Portugal, France, Romania and Slovenia.
Sofia Batica is our correspondent in Rome.
So it was actually one of the biggest investigations to have been carried out against the 'Ndrangheta ever. So really significant. We know that we had sort of countries working together, like Italy, France, Germany and Belgium. So it was an international police operation. I just heard from some of the top anti-mafia prosecutors here in Italy who held a press conference just a few minutes ago. And they talked about an operation of unprecedented in terms of scale. We know that over 100 people have been arrested on charges that go from international drug trafficking, money laundering and possession of weapons. Also, millions of euros have been seized, as well as tons and tons of drugs, especially cocaine and heroin. And also, Italian police have released a video that shows all the items that have been seized, which include gold bars, handguns, assault rifles and stacks of cash.
And this investigation, I understand, used new techniques to reveal some crucial information. Tell us more about this.
That's right. So a lot of these mafia, you know, Ndrangheta members use cryptic messages, nicknames, and they talk in codes. And so police said that they use very sophisticated message decryption systems. They also said that this investigation is really important because it revealed new information about how some of the sort of highest levels of the Ndrangheta operated, especially during COVID. So essentially, we have more information now about how they flooded Europe with drugs that were shipped from South America, how they laundered money in several European countries. For example, in Germany, they've uncovered a widespread network of restaurants, you know, pizzerias, ice cream shops that were used for money laundering.
Sofia Batizza in Rome. America is facing an epidemic of loneliness. That's the warning from the US Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, who says loneliness is as dangerous to health as smoking a dozen cigarettes a day. Dr. Murthy has issued a health advisory calling for social isolation to be treated as seriously as obesity or drug abuse. He's been talking to the BBC's Azadeh Mashiri in Washington.
There are many people who struggle with loneliness who feel a real sense of shame about it. In America, one in two adults report measurable levels of loneliness, and we know that kids and young adults are struggling with very high levels. But this is not something we should be ashamed of. It's something that we should confront, something that we should talk about, and something that we should address.
The emotional toll it can take is perhaps more intuitive, the fact that it can lead to a rise in feelings of anxiety and depression. But here are some of the other statistics that you laid out. You said it increases the risk of heart disease by 29%. It increases the risk of dementia by 50% and stroke by 32%. Were you surprised when you learned the physical toll this can take on someone?
I was surprised because when I went through medical school, I didn't really learn about loneliness and isolation. We didn't really understand it at that time as a health issue. But what I've learned since then is that it absolutely is. In addition to raising the risk of depression, anxiety, and suicide, the increase in risk of physical illness like cardiovascular disease, dementia, and stroke is profound. It also may surprise people to learn that the increased risk of premature death that's associated with social connection is on par with the risk that we see from smoking daily and greater than the risk we see associated with obesity. So this is a profound public health challenge, and it's why we have to address it with the focus and the resources and the attention that we afford to public health issues like tobacco, diabetes, and obesity. But in addition to government, it's important to note that there are steps that workplaces can take to foster greater connection among workers. And that's actually good for people and it's good for business. There's steps schools can take so that children know how to manage emotions and can build healthy relationships. And finally, there's steps we can take as individuals, simply spending 15 minutes a day with people we love, making sure that we are present when we're talking to other people and not distracted by our devices, and looking for ways to help one another, recognizing service as a powerful antidote to loneliness. These can all help.
The US Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. Still to come on this podcast. Some of America's best-known late-night talk show hosts have been taken off air due to a strike by Hollywood writers over money and the use of artificial intelligence.
The Global Jigsaw is the new podcast from BBC Monitoring, the BBC team tracking and analysing media in 100 languages. We're lifting the language barrier, showing you the world through the eyes of its media, where conflicting narratives are competing to influence your views. Search for The Global Jigsaw wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In 2012, a new charity bursts onto the scene. It's called Believe in Magic, and it grants wishes to seriously ill children. It has the support of the biggest boy band in the world, One Direction. It's run by an inspirational 16-year-old girl called Megan Bari, who herself is battling a brain tumour.
I've been in and out of hospital and seen so many other very poorly children.
But when questions arise about her story, they reveal she could be facing another very different danger.
What is this girl going through?
It wasn't supposed to end like this.
Listen to Believe in Magic with me, Jamie Bartlett.
The United Nations is asking the two warring generals in Sudan to give aid workers security guarantees so they can deliver much-needed supplies to tens of thousands of people caught up in the fighting. For almost 3 weeks, the Sudanese army has been at war with the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces. The UN's humanitarian chief, Martin Griffiths, arrived in the city of Port Sudan this morning. He said that the region of Darfur has the greatest need after the UN's World Food Programme supplies there were stolen. Mr. Griffiths also said people in Khartoum were desperate. Tomorrow, a seven-day ceasefire is due to start, but he said that even if this didn't hold, he still expected aid to get through.
It's not as if we're asking for the moon. We're asking for the movement of humanitarian supplies and people. We do this in every other country, even without ceasefires. It's a tradition of the humanitarian enterprise to go where others don't. And then we need to absolutely embed those commitments into clear local arrangements.
Our Africa correspondent Mercy Juma is in Kenya. She told me people were hopeful the truce would hold long enough to allow the arrival of aid.
It is quite a big ask, but one that everyone is hopeful that the two warring generals will actually hint to, because they have, you know, allowed, even amidst the fighting, they have at least allowed people to be evacuated. So it's time for them to at least allow those who are remaining behind to access or get the much needed aid that they need to have. We are looking at more than 330,000 people that need to be reached by these humanitarian agencies, including the UN. So it's hopeful that they do not have an option but to yield to this.
Do we know how much aid Sudan actually needs right now?
So we cannot tell how much aid the country needs now, but UN OCHA says that they have a funding gap of about $1.5 billion today. And this amount will definitely go up because if the fighting continues, because it means more people are getting killed, more people are getting wounded. And also we are not looking at the countries that are now taking in refugees, including Chad, you know, Ethiopia, Egypt, who have their own issues and are burdened by other things that may also need to rely on humanitarian agencies for more aid.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is in Nairobi today in neighbouring Kenya. What's he hoping for?
So what we are hoping for is that he will put more pressure to the warring generals to at least cease fire and allow for mediation efforts to go on. The three presidents, including Kenya's president, William Ruto, who had been fronted by IGAD to go and mediate in Sudan, have not been able to go because of the situation there. So what you're expecting is just more pressure from Guterres and other agencies and, you know, the region and globally for these two to cease fire, which is what everybody is asking for right now, at least for humanitarian passage like Griffith has requested.
Mercy Juma in Nairobi. As the coronation of King Charles III approaches, Republican sentiment in Australia is stirring again. Campaigners argue that Australia's constitutional monarchy, where King Charles is the head of state, is outdated, although they have yet to settle on the type of republic model they favour. Supporters of the British royal family, however, believe the monarchy has made Australia politically and socially stable. The country's Labour government is promising a referendum in the next few years, but constitutional change is rare. Only 8 out of 44 referendums have been passed in Australia since 1901. Phil Mercer reports.
Prince Charles, the 17-year-old heir to the throne, arrives in Sydney on his way to attend school at Timberton.
King Charles first visited Australia in 1966 and has a special connection to the country.
There's a big crowd to see him here too, but the young prince takes it all in his stride.
But the death of the Queen has once again reignited debate about constitutional reform. Matt Thistlethwaite is Australia's Assistant Minister for the Republic. He believes that change is well overdue.
We woke up in September last year when the Queen passed away, and all of a sudden we had a new head of state. The Australian people weren't consulted about that. The Australian people didn't get a choice in who should be their head of state, despite the fact that we govern by democratic means.
The Queen's reign is over, Charles is king, and now there's a renewed push to make Australia a republic. We've been asked once before, and it was on this date in 1999. The country said no.
Australia voted against severing its ties to the British crown in 1999. But Adam Spencer from the Australian Republic movement senses a new opportunity.
He is King Charles of Australia. In 2023, does it feel right for our head of state to be a foreign-born king? We say no. It should be one of us who serves in that position for all of us.
Here is high history in the making. As the Gothic steams into the majesty of Sydney Harbour, a royal setting for a royal arrival. Hardly another city in all the world could open so splendid a gateway for a sovereign and her husband. For the Queen is coming, our Queen.
Queen Elizabeth was widely admired and respected here. Supporters of the monarchy believe the system has made Australia's democracy safe and secure. Here are the views of two activists, Alessandro Rossini and Rachel Bales.
They do not come here as peripheral gossip figures. They come here as people that have a role in our constitution. I believe that a constitutional monarchy is a system that works. It allows our government to get on with the business of serving the people of Australia through hard-nosed issues like the economy, energy crisis, housing affordability.
I am a constitutional monarchist and I'm a proud constitutional monarchist. And I say that both as a young Australian and also as someone of a strong multicultural background given my Greek and Italian descent.
Let's talk about Australia's next head of state.
In our current system, that person will be the head of the royal family in England.
Ultimately, it will be up to about 18 million Australian voters to decide the country's constitutional future.
Phil Mercer in Australia. America's most popular late-night talk shows have been forced off the air and replaced by repeats just hours after Hollywood writers began their first strike in 15 years. The Writers' Union is in dispute with the body representing studios and streamers about pay and the use of artificial intelligence. From Los Angeles, Sophie Long sent this report.
Writers downed their pens and took to the streets with lifted fists as picket lines formed outside major studios across Los Angeles. At the Sunset Bronson Studios, which is home to Netflix, several hundred members of the Writers Guild marched defiantly as cars beeped their horns in support. Representatives of the studios and streamers said they'd offered generous increases in compensation before the strike was called on Monday. But the Writers' Union is demanding higher minimum salaries, more writers per show, and a commitment on not replacing writers with AI. Late-night talk shows, which would normally have staff writers script jokes for the hosts hours before they go to air, were the first to feel the fallout. But the strike's impact could yet delay the autumn release of popular scripted shows, if it continues over the summer.
Sophie Long in Los Angeles. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and was mixed by Annie Smith. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
The documentary brings together the best of factual storytelling from across the BBC World Service.
This is a historic opportunity for peace.
To end violence for good in Northern Ireland.
Exploring the world around us and bringing the globe to your ears.
The invasion meant that the lives of millions of Iraqis changed forever.
There are still some memories that I can't talk about.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.